Hello and welcome to Eye to the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center of Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. It's 7 a.m. here in Seattle today, but it's midnight in Japan, where we're talking with Dr. Vincent Torley, who is a PhD in philosophy from the University of Melbourne, who teaches in Japan. He's also a writer for the popular blog Uncommon Descent, which has some great content supporting intelligent design. So, Dr. Torley, thanks for coming back on the show with us here.
Happy to be here, Casey.
Well, Dr. Torley, we want to pick up the conversation that we had in the previous podcast discussing an op-ed that Eric Metaxas wrote in the Wall Street Journal on Christmas Day, arguing that modern science points towards theism rather than against it. And as we talked about in the previous podcast, some religious people who you would think would be friendly to intelligent design don't always turn out to like intelligent design after all. But your recent defense of Eric Metaxas cited some great scientific data and religious authorities showing that religious people can be very confident that ID is an argument that's both intellectually sound and consistent with their worldview. So let's continue this conversation, Dr. Torley.
Sure.
I want to hit at another really crucial point that I think you made in your article. Now, I personally am not Catholic, Vince, so you're going to have to help me here, but I understand that you are a Catholic philosopher.
Yes, that's right.
And so you note in your article that Pope Pius XII has made some really striking comments that affirm us when we want to look at science and see if that makes an argument for God. Could you maybe elaborate on what Pope Pius XII said as far as our ability to use science to see whether God exists? What did he say, and how does this address whether or not, as a Catholic or as any Christian, we should have freedom to look at science when asking the question of whether God exists?
Well, sure, Casey, I'd be happy to answer that. Now, there was a talk, an address, given by Pope Pius XII to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences on November the 22nd, 1951, and it was titled, The Proofs for the Existence of God in the Light of Modern Natural Science. It's available online, by the way. And I'll just quote a couple of passages from that talk. In paragraph 2, he says, in fact, according to the measure of its progress, and contrary to affirmations advanced in the past, true science discovers God in an ever-increasing degree, as though God were waiting behind every door opened by science. And then later on, in paragraph 44, he adds, it is undeniable that when a mind enlightened and enriched with modern scientific knowledge weighs this problem calmly, it feels drawn to break through the circle of completely independent or autochthonous matter, whether uncreated or self-created, and to ascend to a creating spirit. And he adds in the same paragraph, in fact, it would seem that present-day science, with one sweeping step back across millions of centuries, has succeeded in bearing witness to that primordial fiat lux, let there be light, uttered at the moment when, along with matter, there burst forth from nothing a sea of light and radiation, while the particles of chemical elements split and formed into millions of galaxies. And he goes on to add that science has confirmed the contingency of the universe, and also the well-founded deduction as to the epoch when the cosmos came forth from the hands of the Creator. And then in paragraph 51 he remarks, hence creation took place in time. Therefore there's a Creator, therefore God exists. So I don't think Pope Pius was at all afraid of invoking science in support of belief in God. I think he was very on board with the new discoveries, and I think he was eager to use them as an argument for God's existence that would convince other people who might perhaps not be inclined to listen to metaphysical arguments.
Yes, Vince, I think you made some really strong points here. Obviously, it's hard to find an authority on religion and philosophy and the way we should approach faith that's a stronger one than the Pope. And so when the Pope says that it is legitimate to look at science to find evidence for God's existence, wow, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd like to ask you, and I say this as a non-Catholic myself, who certainly respects my many Catholic friends and their faith and the tradition that they represent, what does it mean for Catholics when the Pope says that it's okay to do something And then we see maybe other Catholic philosophers who would almost seem to be disagreeing with the Pope. I mean, I'm sure that it's okay to disagree with the Pope, but that seems to be an interesting maybe disconnect there. What's going on here when one Catholic philosopher tells us that we should not be looking at science for God's existence, but then the Pope is saying otherwise?
Okay. Well, I should point out that Catholics are free to disagree with popes on certain matters. For example, although popes are held to be infallible when teaching or defining dogmas relating to faith and morals, papal infallibility certainly doesn't extend to scientific matters. And even when popes speak about faith and morals, they seldom or very rarely speak infallibly. That's only about once a century, basically. But I should point out in all fairness that not everyone, even in his day, agreed with him. Among those who disagreed was actually Father Georges Lemaître, father of the Big Bang hypothesis himself, who, although he agreed that there seemed to be evidence of a beginning, was rather unwilling to say that science had uttered the final word on the universe as having had a beginning. And that's why he was a bit worried when he heard Pope Pius XII's address. He thought it was perhaps a bit premature to make a pronouncement like that. So I think he perhaps wished that the Pope had held back. But that talk was given in 1951. And since then, as it turns out, the evidence from fine-tuning has come in, and that's actually strengthened the scientific argument for God's existence. So far from science having moved away from God, it's actually moved towards God in the last few decades. So I think that's an encouraging sign.
Yes, and that gets back to sort of your Nervous Nellie's point, that we can see the trend line of the evidence, where if over many decades, the more we look at science in every direction seems to be pointing towards this fine-tuning that seems to suggest, as you, I think, put it well, that the universe is balanced on the knife's edge as far as the probability of life being able to exist. And we just see as the more evidence that we find, the more data that comes in supports that fine-tuning of the universe. Then at some point we can begin to really gain confidence that, hey, there's really something here, and I think maybe it's safe to say, look, science could be making an argument for God's existence.
Well, yes, I think we should follow the evidence where it leads. And right at the moment, there seems to be a mountain of evidence, scientific evidence relating to the universe as having had a beginning, relating to the parameters of the cosmos and even the laws of the cosmos being fine-tuned for life, and also the universe is being fine-tuned for discoverability by intelligent beings. And on top of that, the sheer improbability of life having emerged in the first place, followed by the massive improbability of complex animal life emerging, which I think has been highlighted by Dr. Stephen Meyer in his book Darwin's Doubt. When you consider all these facts, it would be foolish to set aside that evidence and try to reach people solely on the basis of metaphysical arguments, which might impress some people, but might have difficulty in getting through to others. So I would say don't put all your eggs in one basket. If you're trying to reach people, try to reach them through as many avenues as possible. That would be my philosophy.
Okay, well, Dr. Torley, I think that you've established that even if it's okay for Catholics to disagree with the Pope on certain types of issues, it's pretty difficult for a Catholic to argue persuasively that it's illegitimate to do something if the Pope has already said that that thing is legitimate to do. And in this case, what we're talking about, of course, is whether it's legitimate to look at science and cite scientific evidence when making an argument for God. Now, I suppose that a Catholic philosopher could object and say that it's outside the realm of sound theology in the Catholic tradition to use science to argue for God, but their objections are undercut pretty badly when the Pope himself has said that it is permissible to look at science when making an argument for God. And I think that the quote that you've given from Pope Pius XII show pretty persuasively that it is acceptable for a Catholic and within the Catholic tradition to use science when making an argument for God. Okay, so now that I think you've established that the Pope is not against us supporting ID and that it is okay to use science when making an argument for God, let's talk about another important Catholic authority and whether he would have supported intelligent design, namely Thomas Aquinas. The great philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas is, in the popular view, often identified with being favorable to intelligent design, but some folks who are called Neo-Thomists are against intelligent design. So who are these Neo-Thomists, and what do they believe, and do you think that Thomas would have supported intelligent design? And I'll confess that I'm not a philosopher or a theologian, and I'm also not Catholic. So can you help us understand this issue?
Okay, I'd be happy to help out there, Casey. I know it's a bit of a tricky one. I should say something about this. There are a number of very educated Thomist thinkers, whom I greatly respect, who nevertheless oppose intelligent design, and at the same time there are other Thomist thinkers who support intelligent design. So amongst Thomist philosophers there's a bit of a division, you might say. I have, however, done an extensive study of the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas on issues relating to origin, and I'd be happy to give a couple of little quotes which I think will show beyond reasonable doubt to most listeners that he would have been favorable towards intelligent design. First of all, I'd like to quote from a passage in his work, Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 3, Chapter 99, Paragraph 9, where he writes, "Divine power can sometimes produce an effect without prejudice to its providence, apart from the order implanted in natural things by God. In fact, he does this at times to manifest his power, for it can be manifested in no better way that the whole of nature is subject to the divine will than by the fact that he sometimes does something outside the order of nature. Indeed, this makes it evident that the order of things has proceeded from him, not by natural necessity, but by free will." So there Aquinas is saying that God's power and voluntary agency can be manifested in no better way than by the fact that he sometimes does something outside the order of nature. So I think there he shows that he would have had no qualms about appealing to supernatural effects in order to convince skeptics of God's existence. There's another passage in the same work of his, Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 3, Chapter 100, Paragraph 6 and 7, where Aquinas writes that the whole of nature is like an artifact of the divine artistic mind, but it's not contrary to the essential character of an artist. If he should work in a different way on his product, even after he's given it its first form, neither then is it against nature if God does something to natural things in a different way from that to which the course of nature is accustomed. So there he shows that he's quite open to the possibility of a God who supernaturally acts upon nature. He would have had no problems with that. I think then that people who invoke Aquinas to oppose intelligent design have overlooked these passages. And I'd like to finish up by quoting another couple of passages where he actually seems to give a proto-intelligent design argument. Now, I'd like to explain the background of this one. Okay. Aquinas himself believed, as did nearly everyone in his day, that it was possible for some living things to originate spontaneously from non-living matter. We might laugh at this belief today, but back in the Middle Ages, it seemed to be a matter of practical common sense. Sometimes you got flies and maggots appearing out of dead meat and things like that, and the common sense interpretation back then would have been that you've got living things appearing out of dead matter. So that he took for granted. But at the same time, he was also aware of the fact that other animals reproduce sexually and that they had to have parents of the same species as themselves. And he called these animals perfect animals, produced from seed. He didn't know about female ovum because it wasn't observed under the microscope until 1827. So there's a passage in his Summa Theologica, question 91, article 2, in reply to objection 2, where he writes, "Perfect animals produced from seed cannot be made by the sole power of a heavenly body, as Avicenna imagined." So there he's saying that inanimate bodies acting upon non-living matter can't generate these higher animals. He goes on, "But the power of heavenly bodies suffices for the production of some imperfect animals from properly disposed matter." And then he explains why. "For it is clear that more conditions are required to produce a perfect than an imperfect thing." Now, what's the relevance of this? Well, there's another passage where he talks about the origin of the first perfect animal. And he argues that heavenly bodies were insufficient to generate the forms of new baby animals, perfect animals that are sexually generated for these animals. All they do is act as enablers. They're necessary but not sufficient causes of the forms of these animals. that these animals can't be generated by dead or decaying matter. They need parents to generate them, which raises the question, where did the first animals of these kinds come from? Where did the forms of the first animals come from? And Aquinas' answer in his Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 2, Chapter 43, Paragraph 6, is that the primary establishment of these forms must of necessity proceed from the Creator alone. So what he's saying there is that if you're asking where did the first animals come from, sexually reproducing animals, the only answer you can give is they must come from the Creator. Now, back in Aquinas' day, of course, he realized that there were some people, Aristotle among them, who supposed that the universe had always existed and that perhaps people had always been here and perhaps animals had always been here. But today we know better. Today we know that the universe had a beginning. So we know that there was, in fact, a first animal. If Aquinas had known that, then I think perhaps he would have included this argument among his five ways as an additional demonstration for the existence of the Creator.
Well, Vince or Dr. Torley, I just want to say that we really appreciate you taking the time today to come on ID the Future to share with us your expertise, both from science and philosophy, that there is scientific evidence that points to a God who created the universe and caused it to begin and also caused it to be fine-tuned for life, and helping us to sort of parse through these complicated philosophical issues that I think you actually have done a great job of simplifying and helping our listeners to understand. So thank you so much for coming on ID the Future with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Casey. Delighted to help.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Don't let anyone tell you that you're not allowed to make an argument for God from science. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.